Welcome to your weekly constitutional, a radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Let me ask you a question. I'd like you to imagine that you are the President of the United States. You're sitting there in the Oval Office. It's a nice sunny day, things are looking good, and all of a sudden one of your aides comes in and tells you that somebody, somewhere, has blown up a major building in a major city of the United States. It's a terrorist attack. "We think we know who did it," your aide says. What do you do? Of course, you want to catch this perpetrator. Of course, you want to punish this perpetrator, but do you send the FBI to investigate, to apprehend, to try and hopefully convict and then ultimately punish this person? Or do you call the Secretary of Defense, launch an invasion, send in the troops, and simply kill whomever you believe has perpetrated this terrible act? Both options are available to you because the United States Constitution gives the president broad executive authority to see that the laws are faithfully executed, but also specifically gives him something we call the commander-in-chief power. So the president has a choice. You, if you're the president, would have a choice. Do I investigate this as a crime, or do I treat it as an act of war? Well, if you pay any attention at all to the news over the last 10 years or so, you know where I'm headed with this. We've had almost exactly the same terrorist act committed in two different places. One of them, of course, in New York City on 9/11, we treated as a military attack on the United States. The other one in Oklahoma City only a few years earlier, we treated as a criminal act. So we went out and we investigated and we convicted and ultimately executed Timothy McVeigh after giving him a full trial. We didn't do the same for Osama bin Laden. We hunted him down, and recently, we killed him. Which of these two tracks would you follow? What are the considerations that you would consider? And is it ultimately constitutional for you to decide on the military track, to simply go out, hunt down, and kill someone you suspect of committing an act of terrorism? We're going to talk today with two extraordinary fellows, both of them highly, highly qualified to comment on this subject area. The first of them is John Bellinger, who has had an extraordinarily impressive career in the United States government. He was the legal advisor to the National Security Council, and also legal advisor to the Department of State under Condoleezza Rice. He was the highest-ranking international lawyer in the federal government. While he was there, he opined on many of the very issues we'll be discussing today. I also spoke to Professor Robert F. Turner from the University of Virginia, where he runs the entire National Security Law Center, with Professor John Norton Moore as well. He has extensive experience in this area as well, has written extensively on national security issues. And, well, I'll let these gentlemen speak for themselves. We'll start with John Bellinger. John Bellinger of Arnold and Porter, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Stuart.
All right. Well, let's cut right to the chase, shall we? Was it constitutional for us to go out and kill Osama bin Laden?
Well, it was certainly constitutional. In fact, beyond being constitutional, there was a congressional statute that clearly authorized it. In some of these cases where the U.S. is using force against terrorists around the world, the president must rely on his powers as commander-in-chief and chief executive under the Constitution to authorize the use of force, and there's not an additional congressional authorization. And that happens in some cases and results in questions about whether the president has the power to act alone. But in this case, that was not the situation because shortly after 9/11, Congress passed a statute called the Authorization to Use Military Force Act that clearly authorized the president to use force necessary against those who had planned, committed, carried out, or harbored or aided and abetted those who had carried out 9/11. And so that statute remains on the books and is the statutory basis for our use of force to kill or to detain members of al-Qaeda around the world. And since Osama bin Laden, of course, is the clear planner of 9/11, he falls clearly within that congressional authorization. So in this case, absolutely no question that the president had the authority, not just acting on his own under the Constitution, but under a clearly articulated statute passed by Congress to use force against members of al-Qaeda and those who had carried out 9/11.
Well, that's very interesting because you use both the terms to either kill or detain him. And of course, none of us knows exactly what the order was that went out from the White House or through the Secretary of Defense to the actual SEAL team that went to Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. But assuming for the moment, let's just assume that the order was a so-called kill order, that the president simply said, go out there and don't bring him back except if he's dead. Bring back his body. What I'm hearing you saying is that was within the president's power. He didn't need to make any effort to try to detain or capture bin Laden. He could simply say, he's our enemy. We're going to go get him.
That's right. The congressional authorization is to use force against those who planned or carried out 9/11. And it's a very short statute, only a couple of sentences long. It doesn't go into lots of definitions about what force is. It just says the president is authorized to use force against those who committed 9/11. So that is an authorization generally accepted to use military force to kill people. That's the authorization for some of our drone strikes. It was the authorization when our military went into Afghanistan in the fall of 2001 and engaged in hostilities to kill people there. Actually, what became something more of a question since then is, well, does the use of force also include the power, the lesser power, not just to kill members of al-Qaeda, but to detain them? Because the congressional statute doesn't specifically use the words detain. It doesn't say that you're also authorized to detain members of al-Qaeda. But since the fall of 2001, for the last 10 years, the president has relied, both President Bush and now President Obama, have relied on that authorization to use military force statute to not only kill but to detain members of al-Qaeda, so that all the members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban who are still being detained in Guantanamo today are being held under that authorization to use military force statute.
Well, that's interesting you should say that. I hadn't thought about the reverse of it, whether the authorization to use military force would actually include the authority to detain. But that also is a way to look at it, and it certainly is an issue. And since you brought up Guantanamo, I know that you were involved in at least some of the administration's deliberations on what were the appropriate things to do there. What are your thoughts on Guantanamo and how we can resolve the remaining issues that are there?
Well, Guantanamo, Stuart, has been a difficult issue for the United States, and my own views on it have changed over time. In the very beginning, Guantanamo was thought by the Bush administration to be the best place to detain individuals who were captured in Afghanistan because there was still a hot war war going on in Afghanistan in 2001, 2002. Our military leaders did not want to hold members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban inside Afghanistan while hostilities were going on. We obviously didn't want to bring people into the United States at that point in 2001, 2002. And so Guantanamo, an island where there was a naval base, seemed to be a convenient place to hold people. And that we started off originally with about 770 people being held there. As I said, not because they were criminal suspects, but because they were detained under this congressional authorization. I have to say that although there are still many dangerous people being held at Guantanamo, my own view has evolved over the years. By about the middle of my time in the Bush administration, by 2003, 2004, I came to the belief that actually Guantanamo does us more harm than good. It is indisputably a convenient place to hold these dangerous individuals, but it has become, in my view, such a controversial point around the world. It seems to be a place where the United States is holding individuals and mistreating them and holding them outside the rule of law, even though those things are not true. But that is the perception around the world, that in my view, I have supported the closure of Guantanamo and the movement of these people who are being held there into military prisons inside the United States. Just to end that thought, of course, President Obama tried to do that and said he wanted to close Guantanamo, which, of course, President Bush had also said he would like to move to the day that Guantanamo would be closed. But a majority of both houses of Congress have passed legislation that would prevent any individuals from being moved from Guantanamo into the United States. So it looks like Guantanamo will be open for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's kind of hard for President Obama to keep his campaign promise if the Congress is not going to let him do that, the promise to close that that prison there. But other than the PR problem, does your solution actually solve anything constitutionally? I mean, if we're simply moving them from one military prison in Cuba to other military prisons in the United States, doesn't that simply leave us pretty much where we were? I mean, we still have the issue of what to do with these people, how long to detain them, how to dispose of their cases.
Well, absolutely. We would, if they were moved, say, to a military prison inside the United States, they would still be being held under the same authority, the authorization to use military force. They would be held as combatants in a conflict with al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The president would not be changing the legal theory under which he was holding them. Now, it's important to understand that in either case, whether they're held inside the United States or held in Guantanamo, both President Bush and President Obama have said that they want to prosecute some of them, as many as they can, for any war crimes that they have committed. Now, the distinction is important that they are not being held because they committed war crimes. They are being held because they are combatants in a war, and you can, and under general principles of the laws of war, a country can hold individuals until the end of a conflict.
Well, can I interrupt?
They would go back to fighting you again.
Yeah, let me interrupt you there. Now, that's not, yeah. And we'll talk about the potential of trials and how those trials might go forward with alleged war crimes. But if you simply look at it initially as a group of what we used to call POWs. POWs were typically held till the end of a war. What happens if this war doesn't end? What happens if the struggle against al-Qaeda goes on indefinitely? Does that mean that we essentially hold them indefinitely?
Well, the answer to that is, as a legal matter, yes. The United States asserts that right. Both President Bush and President Obama have asserted the right under general principles of the laws of war to hold these members of al-Qaeda and the Taliban until the end of the war with al-Qaeda. Now, that's been a very controversial theory around the world for the reason that you suggest. that could go on indefinitely. Other countries, critics in other countries have suggested that because this might go on too long, that we shouldn't be able to hold people until the end of the conflict, and that we should only be able to hold them if we can try them for crimes. It is indisputably a concern that to say that we will hold people until the end of hostilities could end up being a very long time. Although I would say that even in a conventional war, and by that I mean a war between two states, two countries, that is, that you don't know when the end of the war is going to be. For American or German or Japanese prisoners of war captured in 1941, 1942, they didn't know that the war was going to be over in 3 or 4 years. As far as they were concerned, it might have gone on for decades.
Yeah, that's certainly true. It's true of any struggle. I guess it just seems a little bit less likely in the case of Al-Qaeda that we're ever going to conclude any sort of peace treaty with them. And that, of course,
absolutely, and that is frankly one of the challenges, Stuart, to us as lawyers when we are dealing with a conflict between a country like the United States and a non-country like Al Qaeda, where you have a bunch of people who are not representing a country but are basically representing an ideology. And so, for 10 years, lawyers in both the Bush and the Obama administrations, and frankly around the world, have struggled with how we apply traditional rules of war or traditional criminal laws to this sort of military conflict between a state and individuals who are representing a non-state. It's resulted in a lot of criticism of both the Bush and the Obama administrations, critics have had a hard time articulating really what the rules ought to be. We're really in a new kind of a conflict.
Yeah, it's quite a conundrum because, as you point out, if the conflict's going on, it's very difficult to justify releasing somebody who might just turn right around and start fighting against you again. That's very tough, but it also leads to the seemingly paradoxical situation that even if we do try some subset of those people at Guantanamo for alleged war crimes, whether we try them in a military tribunal or in a civilian court, you might actually have a circumstance where someone goes through a trial, is acquitted, and yet still is detained because he's
absolutely
still an enemy combatant.
I mean,
as a practical matter, it makes you wonder why you would even bother having a trial for somebody if we're not going to let him go anyway.
Well, that's absolutely right. That hasn't happened yet. But I think both the Bush and the Obama administration's legal theory, which is that we are detaining people because they are combatants, but we might also prosecute them for war crimes, would mean that if they are acquitted of the crime, they might still continue to be detained as a combatant if we felt that they were likely to go back to the fight. That is a legal theory that both Bush administration and Obama administration lawyers have been comfortable asserting, but it has been one that has raised some concerns around the world.
Yeah, lots of things. And, of course, you used to work for our Secretary of State. Could you describe some of those reactions from around the world and how we've responded to them?
Well, the Bush administration theory and continued by the Obama administration was that we have been in a state of armed conflict with Al-Qaeda, that this is really a similar to a traditional kind of a war, except that it is between a country and a non-country, and that we've tried to apply as best we can the traditional rules of war. Other countries, particularly in Europe, have rejected that legal framework and have said, we just don't buy the idea that you're in a war with Al-Qaeda. We think wars only occur between countries. And in our countries, when we in Europe have had to face the threat of terrorism, the IRA or the Red Brigades or the Red Army faction. We've just treated those people as criminals, and when we catch them, we don't detain them as combatants. We prosecute them for crimes, and then we hold them. So we don't understand why you in the United States don't do that as well. And so that's been quite difficult for both administrations to explain to our allies around the world. Now, the difference is, and the answer that we've provided, is that in all of those cases in Europe, those individuals from domestic terrorist groups were captured inside those individual countries, in Ireland or in Germany or in Italy, where the criminal laws applied and where the state law enforcement officials could just arrest an IRA terrorist and clap the handcuffs on them and prosecute them for a crime. We continue to do that in this country all the time. As Stuart, as you know, and your listeners know from reading the newspapers, we continue to catch Al-Qaeda members or Al-Qaeda sisters inside this country, and then we prosecute them for violations of federal law. But when our soldiers capture people in Afghanistan or elsewhere in the midst of a hot conflict with their guns out, our criminal laws don't necessarily apply over there, and our soldiers are not catching people because they are criminals and they're engaged in a law enforcement operation. They are using force to kill or to detain individuals in an armed conflict. So this has been something that the United States government, through the State Department and our Defense Department, have tried to explain the laws that we are applying to other countries, and it has been a challenge. Coming back to your first question about Bin Laden, even though I think most people around the world are glad to see Bin Laden gone, even some other countries have suggested, well, you may have a legal basis under your constitution to, or under your statutes to have killed Bin Laden, but how can this be permissible under international law for you to conduct a raid inside Pakistan to kill someone? You're not at war with Pakistan. How can you have gone and done that? And the Obama administration has been explaining to other countries what the legal basis is to act in self-defense against Bin Laden.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about whether it was constitutional to kill Osama bin Laden. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll talk some more with former legal advisor to the State Department and the National Security Council, John Bellinger. Stay tuned.
You know, justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your balls, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
And we'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses, singing whiskey for my men.
Once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz, and with me is Kelly Carmichael. Kelly, are you there?
I'm here, Stuart. Hello.
Tremendous. And we have also on the line Eric, our contestant. Eric, are you there?
I'm here.
Tremendous. Eric, where are you from?
I'm from Paris Mountain, South Carolina.
Paris Mountain, South Carolina. I didn't think there were any mountains in South Carolina.
The very tip of the Appalachians, on the eastern side.
The very tip. That's over near Columbia, then.
Greenville area.
Greenville, South Carolina, or nearby. Right, then. Mm-hmm. Tremendous. Well, Kelly, do you have a really tough question for Eric today?
I do, Eric. We're going to dive into an amendment in the Constitution today.
All righty.
All right. Are you ready?
I am.
All right. You sure?
Well, not really, but... Yeah,
he doesn't sound very sure to me, but okay.
I'm committed.
Okay, he's committed. All right.
Committed. Good, good, good. All right. I'm going to read you a portion of the 15th Amendment from the Constitution, and the question that goes along with that amendment is which of these principles, the principles which I will list, of government, are reflected in the 15th Amendment. And your choice, answer choices will be judicial review, federalism, separation of powers, or popular sovereignty. All right, so here we go. The 15th Amendment, portions of it. The rights of citizens to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition or servitude. Again, which of the principles that I'll list are reflected in the 15th Amendment? Is it judicial review, federalism, separation of powers, or popular sovereignty?
And what was the quoted language again?
Again, from the 15th Amendment portions of it, the rights of citizens to vote shall not be denied on account of race, color, or previous condition or servitude.
Oh,
of servitude,
right. Okay. This is, of course, the famous amendment, one of the three famous amendments that was adopted in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. Sometimes we call them the Civil War Amendments. Sometimes we call them the Reconstruction Amendments. And along with the 13th, which abolished slavery, and the 14th, which contains the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause, this was considered to be part of the great second American founding, when the Constitution was so fundamentally altered, abolishing slavery, etc., that many legal scholars consider it to be the three most significant amendments after the Bill of Rights. So I've stalled enough for you, Eric.
Thank you very much.
I've given you my little mini lecture there. Now you've had a chance to consider which of those four answer choices best reflects that language that Kelly quoted to you. So what do you think? Talk us through your reasoning.
Answer A, judicial review. Judicial review was not established in the Constitution, but through court decisions and precedent. So particularly the case Marbury versus Madison. So that would not be the correct answer.
Okay.
What was B?
B was federalism.
Let's come back to that one.
Okay.
And answer C?
Separation of powers.
Separation of powers is established in the Constitution through the structure of the Constitution, setting up the office of the presidency, the Congress, and the court system. So that would not be the correct answer. And answer D, popular sovereignty, would be more akin to the establishment of the Constitution itself. We the people, giving people the right to vote and the right to elect their own representatives. So I would say that answer B, federalism, has to be the correct answer.
Nope.
Because it was used to essentially reshape the United States and assert federal supremacy over the states in the aftermath of the Civil War.
Well, that's very interesting reasoning. Kelly, did Eric get things correct?
It's good reasoning, but I'll have to go back to your description of popular sovereignty, because you mentioned that popular sovereignty was originally established in the Constitution with we the people, but we the people, when the Constitution was written, left out a significant portion of people. So D is the correct answer for popular sovereignty.
Oh no. Oh, good heavens.
But your rationalization was right on.
Well, you sounded so good, Eric. You sounded so good, right up to the point where you picked the wrong answer.
Not only that, Eric, but you gave us all a good lesson describing all of these important terms.
Yeah, I think the only thing I might quibble with, Eric, was that federalism is really more of a description of the relationship between the states on the one hand and the federal government on the other. And though that was certainly affected by the Civil War, and federal sovereignty, federal supremacy was sort of definitively established by the fact of the Union winning the Civil War, it was actually a concept that long predated it. It goes all the way back to Article 6 and the Supremacy Clause. So that's the reason that was not the correct answer with regard to the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment guaranteed voting rights to former slaves. And in that regard, it extended popular sovereignty to that group of people. So that's why I think that was a correct answer choice.
That makes a whole lot more sense.
Well,
nice try, Eric.
Extremely nice try. And you do get our consolation prize, what every contestant gets, and that's a copy of the Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier.
I'll go back and reread the 15th Amendment.
You're a good sport, Eric. Thank you for playing.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, Eric.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're discussing the question, was it constitutional to kill Osama bin Laden? Let's continue our discussion with John Bellinger, former legal advisor to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and before that, legal advisor to the National Security Council. Yeah, you're doing a very good job of explaining the rationale here, John, but I must say that the essential problem is that it's such an important distinction as to whether we treat somebody on the one hand as an enemy combatant or on the other hand as a criminal defendant. And as you've pointed out, we do both. I mean, if we catch somebody within the geographical boundaries of the United States, we're going to give them a trial. And we'll either convict them or we won't. And if we don't, we're going to release them. But if the people are overseas, like bin Laden was, like most of al-Qaeda is, then it goes down an entirely different track. And that's what people have difficulty wrapping their minds around. On the one hand, we prosecuted Timothy McVeigh and ultimately executed him, but we gave him all the procedural protections of the federal courts before we did, and we did that because he blew up a building. Well, Osama bin Laden blew up several buildings, and instead of going and capturing him and giving him a trial, we treated him like an enemy combatant, and we killed him. And I think that's the essential disconnection that people apparently all over the world have difficulty understanding.
Well, and that's right. And coming back to the State Department, that is an important role for the State Department, even though the operational work is being done by the Defense Department. It has been important for our State Department, who are our diplomats, to explain our legal basis for the things that we do, because we are a country that is very much committed to being law-abiding under both our Constitution and our laws, but also under traditional international laws. So when we engage in activities that are controversial, like killing bin Laden in another country, using drones in Pakistan, in Yemen, in other places, detaining people for 10 years without trying them, it's been incumbent upon the U.S. government and particularly through the State Department, our diplomats, to explain the legal basis for these actions. But as you point out, these are issues that can be difficult for people to understand, and in particular because this kind of conflict between the United States and a group like al-Qaeda doesn't fit neatly into the traditional examples of wars that we have seen in the past.
No, it does not. We're in a brave new world indeed. Well, before I let you go, though, there's, of course, one other major issue that's come up quite recently and that is causing quite a stir in Congress and throughout our nation, and that is, of course, whether it is constitutional for our president, President Barack Obama, to have engaged in what certainly look like hostilities in Libya. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, yes, and that continues to be a very hot topic here in Washington, where I am, Stuart. President, of course, earlier in the year authorized our armed forces participating with other countries to use force against Gaddafi in Libya in order to prevent him from harming and killing civilians in Libya. And that triggered, in the view of most legal experts, something called the War Powers Resolution, mm-hmm. Which was a statute passed by Congress several decades ago after the Vietnam War that requires the president to notify Congress when he sends American forces equipped for combat into hostilities, and then to limit those hostilities to 60 days unless Congress passes a statute authorizing him to continue. And those 60 days have passed. The War Powers Act, also called the War Powers Resolution, gives the president an extra 30 days to wind down the hostilities before getting congressional authorization. But those additional 30 days have now passed. And so Congress, members of both parties, Republicans and Democrats in both the House and the Senate, have said to the president, you've continued past these 90 days using force and using our military in Libya, and you've not gotten congressional authorization. We think this is a violation of the War Powers Act. Most presidents since Richard Nixon have thought the War Powers Act is not constitutional. All Democratic and Republican presidents have said that Congress cannot tie the president's hands by telling him that he has to pull out troops after 60 or 90 days.
And the reason
for that...
But what
happened in this case, Stuart, is interesting, is that President Obama, instead of saying, well, I'm going to continue hostilities in Libya, and I just think the War Powers Act is unconstitutional, so I'm just going to continue anyway. Instead, last week, the White House issued a paper to Congress saying, well, we don't actually think we're engaged in hostilities in Libya at all, so we don't think the War Powers Resolution is actually triggered. So I'm not going to assert my power under the Constitution to engage in hostilities, notwithstanding the act. I'm going to just take the position that the War Powers Resolution doesn't apply because our level of activities in Libya, which has largely been in a supporting capacity, doesn't rise to the level of hostilities. Now, this
let me ask. I have to interrupt there, John. Yeah. Now, what you have confronted these very sorts of issues in your former former job when you worked for the State Department. What do you think of that argument that we're not engaged in hostilities in Libya right now?
Well, I have to say, I personally don't buy that. I don't think that's the better argument. I think it's an arguable case. In some cases, in past uses of force, presidents have said that a very low-level use of force when there are not actually American troops on the ground in combat, but who are instead are flying around or in a support role, that that's not hostilities. So it is certainly an argument. I just don't buy it in this case, in that to me, the amount of the bombings that we conducted originally and have been supporting ever since for the last 4 months look to me like hostilities. And I think the better argument is that they are hostilities and that the president needs to do either one of two things. Either get congressional authorization consistent with the War Powers Act, or simply say, I think this act is just not constitutional and I'm going to go forward anyway. What's interesting is that apparently both the Justice Department and the Defense Department told the president that they thought that we are engaged in hostilities, but that President Obama overruled both his Justice Department and his Defense Department and has concluded on his own and on the basis of advice from his White House counsel that he's concluded that these are not hostilities. So that's been quite controversial here in Washington, a number of members of Congress have actually filed a lawsuit against the president, both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, he seems to have gone out on a limb. He seems to have gone out on a limb on this one. I mean, not just because...
Gone out on a limb on this one, and I have to say, a number of my colleagues from the previous Bush administration have said that, well, if President Bush had tried to make an argument like this, that this use of force in Libya doesn't really count as hostilities, that he really would have been criticized very severely. So this has been quite controversial here in Washington, and continues to play out.
Well, John Bellinger, I sincerely appreciate your taking the time to give us the benefit of your knowledge and expertise in this area. These are fascinating areas of national security law, and we appreciate it.
Stuart, it's great to be with you and with your listeners, and thank you for taking the time to both talk to me and to try to bring these complicated issues of international national security law to the listeners in your area.
Thanks, John. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we've been discussing all kinds of national security issues with John Bellinger, the former legal advisor to both the State Department and the National Security Council. After the break, we'll get a different perspective on many of these same questions from Professor Robert Turner of the University of Virginia.
Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list, and a Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist, and an eagle will fly. Gonna be here when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. Oh, brought to you courtesy.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're discussing whether it was constitutional to go out and kill Osama bin Laden. Next, we're going to be talking to Professor Robert F. Turner of the University of Virginia School of Law. Professor Turner has extensive scholarship in the area of national security law, and in fact, he runs the Center for National Security at the University of Virginia. Professor Robert Turner of the University of Virginia School of Law, thank you for being with us today.
I'm pleased to be here, Stuart.
Tremendous. May I call you Bob?
I hope you will.
Okay, that's great.
I never answered a bill.
Okay, that's wonderful. Let's get right to it, Bob. Was it constitutional for President Obama to have the Navy SEALs go in and kill Osama bin Laden?
No question about it. The issue here is this a law enforcement operation, or are we in an armed conflict? And the answer is, without doubt, we are in an armed conflict. We know that because President Bush said we were at war, President Obama said we were at war, Congress, by a vote of 518-1, passed a statute called the Authorization for the Use of Military Force back in September 18, 2001, that said the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks in order to prevent future attacks against the United States.
Well, hold on. Let me play devil's advocate, though.
Sure.
As you and I both know, that was called an authorization for use of military force, but it was not called a declaration of war.
It wasn't, but it was the equivalent to a declaration of war. In 1800, in a case called Bass versus Tingey, and in 1801, in a case called Talbot versus Seaman, the U.S. Supreme Court said that Congress could authorize hostilities by joint resolution without formally declaring war. And indeed, one can go further and argue, as I have many times, that the power to declare war is as much an anachronism today as the power given Congress in the same paragraph, in the same sentence, to issue letters of marque and reprisal. As you may remember, back when they wrote the Constitution in 1787, every state had a right to go to war with anyone they wanted for any purpose they wanted, and one of the things they were allowed to do was authorize private owners of ships to go out in the high seas and capture the ships of enemy, nationals, and then bring them back into a prize court. And it was not until 1856 that the international community outlawed letters of marque and reprisal. So no country has issued a letter of marque and reprisal since before the Civil War. In the same way, the types of wars associated with foreign formal declarations, what they used to call perfect war, a situation where all people in one country are at war with all the people in the other, has been outlawed, theoretically at least since 1928 with the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, and clearly since 1945 when the UN Charter was approved. And no country has formally declared war since the UN Charter went into force. So I'm not saying Congress doesn't have tremendously important powers with regard to war, but it's very unlikely we're ever going to formally declare war again. And that particular check against that particular type of what today we would call an all-out aggressive war is pretty much irrelevant. Obviously, if the president decided to invade Canada over some political grievance, Congress would still have its check. but that's not likely to happen. And unless we decide to launch an all-out aggressive war, the power really has no content anymore.
Well, let's reassure our Canadian listeners at this point, there are no plans at the moment, as far as we know, for an aggressive war against Canada.
That's my take on it also.
I'm very pleased to hear that. Now, I'm very glad that you've explained that, because that really clarifies a lot of things. But let's go back a little bit and talk about the treaty power, because as you mentioned a couple of treaties there that we've agreed to. And treaties, as you know, are among the highest laws of the land, according
exactly.
to our Supremacy Clause.
Exactly.
So when we have agreed that there will no longer be, as you call them, perfect wars, then that effectively means that we have agreed in under our constitutional authority that such things are no longer relevant, so as the declaration of war is no longer relevant.
I actually gave a lecture over at the Army JAG School, the Judge Advocate General School, this morning on the situation in Libya and the War Powers Resolution. And one of the things people miss is that Article 2 gives the president the power and duty to see the laws faithfully executed. And among those laws is, you mentioned, the Supremacy Clause, which says this Constitution and laws made pursuant to the Constitution and treaties made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land. And when Congress passed the U.N. Participation Act and the Senate consented to the ratification of the U.N. Charter, both in 1945, the unanimous reports of both the Senate and the House Foreign Affairs Committees said that the duty to carry out our obligations under the U.N. Charter was vested in the president. And indeed, an amendment was submitted in December of 45. Senator Burton Wheeler of Montana, an isolationist Republican, submitted an amendment that said the president could not make troops available to carry out an Article 42 agreement by the decision by the Security Council, that is a use of force decision like we recently saw in Libya, without getting a joint resolution of Congress approving the specific action. And that amendment got 9 votes and was overwhelmingly denounced by the bipartisan leadership of Congress as being inconsistent with the treaty we had already entered into, the U.N. Charter. So the president does have authority to do this. And again, the unanimous Senate Foreign Relations Committee said that a use of force pursuant to a Security Council authorization would not be an act of war, but an act of peace, and therefore did not infringe upon the exclusive power of Congress to declare war. This is all back in the congressional record. You have to dig back in the library, but it's there, and it was a unanimous decision. And so
this is remarkable.
Has a lot of power in this area.
Well, I'll second that. In fact, let me just summarize here then. If we go back to Article 2 or the original 7 Articles of the Constitution, Congress has the power to declare war. But it's been clarified for a couple of hundred years now by the Supreme Court that you don't actually have to go through the formal declaration process. Any sort of resolution by Congress will suffice. Then further, in the 20th century, we entered into a series of treaties that effectively made that irrelevant because those sorts of wars supposedly are going to no longer exist internationally. And if we agree to something like that in a treaty, that's part of the highest law of the land under our Constitution. And then further, when we join the UN pursuant to treaty, we've delegated to the president enormous power to go along with UN resolutions to use force to keep the peace.
Yeah. He, as commander-in-chief, he already had the power to use the military made available by Congress. Remember, the commander-in-chief power is a hollow power without any involvement of Congress. That is
right.
to say, until the Congress raises and supports an army or provides and maintains a navy, the president has no military to command. So I'm not trying to say Congress has no role in this, but it's not the role many people envision. It originally was viewed as a negative or a veto given to Congress on a decision to declare war. Beyond that, the general power of what John Locke called war, peace, leagues, and alliances was vested in the president by Article 2, Section 1, the grant of the executive power. If you go back, one of the classic books, I actually got interested in this issue in 1966 when I heard a lecture by the late Quincy Wright, a very distinguished scholar who was president of the American Political Science Association, the American Society of International Law, major player. And he argued in his 1922 book, The Control of American Foreign Relations, that when Congress gave the executive power to the president, the foreign affairs power was the essential element of the grant. But they provided for negatives by Congress and the Senate, in certain areas. For example, the president cannot make a treaty without the advice and consent of two-thirds of the Senate. It's a non-democratic process by which one-third plus one of the Senate can block a treaty even if the overwhelming majority favor it, and the president cannot appoint a diplomat, an ambassador, without the approval of a majority of the Senate, and the president cannot launch an aggressive all-out war, the kind of war formerly associated with declarations of war. And remember, you go back to August 17th, 1787, the draft before the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia said that Congress shall have the power to make war. They had taken this language from the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
And James Madison and Elbridge Gerry on 17 August introduced a motion to say to give power instead the power to declare war, a more limited power. And they chose a term of art from the Law of Nations. The declaration of war was not all force. They understood the concept of force short of war. And indeed, throughout our history, as the Supreme Court has noted, presidents have sent U.S. forces into harm's way more than 200 times without any involvement by Congress, and seldom with criticism from Congress. There have been a few cases where people have objected. And indeed, I mentioned earlier the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report on the consenting to the ratification of the U.N. Charter. And one of the things they said that they were opposed to further limitations on the president's action because that would interfere with the president's constitutional, well-established constitutional power to use force, short of war. There's a long history to this, and we pretty much, it's almost as if we had a meltdown of our hard drive during the heated debates of Vietnam. In my doctoral dissertation, I track year after year the attitude of both branches on foreign affairs, and throughout our history, really until the 1970s, Congress and the executive and the courts said the executive power clause gives the president the general control of our foreign relations. And then after Vietnam, not even the executive branch was quoting the executive clause. And it was sad. And people would look at the Constitution and say it doesn't mention foreign affairs, doesn't even say national security, so that must be no different than anything else. But as you know, as a law professor, in 1936, in the Curtis Wright case, the Supreme Court said this is a very different power than domestic power. It's mostly confided to the control of the president. And indeed, that one of the lines they said was, into the field of negotiations, the Senate cannot intrude, and Congress itself is powerless to invade it.
The president's the sole organ of foreign policy.
Exactly, and that's actually a sentence from John Marshall, before he became our Chief Justice, was a Federalist member of the House of Representatives. And during a debate on the Jonathan Robbins affair, he argued so persuasively, in fact, that his Republican opponents gave up the fight. He argued that the president is given the executive power. He's in charge of our foreign relations. The issue there was turning over an alleged British mutineer who had been spotted in South Carolina back to the British to be tried. And President Adams ordered that he be apprehended and turned over to the British pursuant to the extradition provisions of the Jay Treaty. And the Republicans said, well, the court should have been involved. The president doesn't have that power. And Marshall got up and gave a brilliant lengthy address explaining why he did and noting that under the Constitution, the president is the sole organ of the nation and its relations with foreign states. And when he finished talking, Albert Gallatin, the Republican leader in the House, who was planned to, these were the two cleanup hitters at a debate that had gone on for over a month. Gallatin did not, he was supposed to stand up and deliver a powerful rebuttal, and his fellow Republicans gathered around him and said, come on, get up, answer him. And Gallatin set down his pen and said, answer him yourself. For me, his arguments are unanswerable. And most of the Republicans then voted with the Federalists to kill the resolution that had attacked Adams, and they passed another resolution saying what he had done was fully consistent with the Constitution. So there's a lot of history
that,
on this.
That is remarkable.
It's been lost from our history books.
Well, okay, you make a very convincing case, too. But let me ask you this now. Let's shift from what is constitutional, what has been constitutional, and let's ask the policy question. Is it a good idea to give any president, whether it's Obama or whether it's Bush or anybody, that much power over war and peace? I mean, the situation in Libya is the current example, but you can pick a dozen others. Is it a good idea that one man should be able to commit us to war?
Yeah, I actually, in 1984-85, I had the great pleasure of serving as acting Assistant Secretary of State for Congressional Relations, and I worked on these issues, and indeed, they were people in the State Department who thought I was nothing but an apologist for Congress because I was a big believer in consultation. Even if it's an area where the president has the power to act, that doesn't mean it's not smart for him to go to Congress, tell them what's going on, seek their advice, and then ultimately it may be his decision until a certain point is reached where he needs a treaty or he needs more money or more military forces, where then it's their decision to make. But working together is almost always the smart thing to do. But the reason that this power was given to the president, and again, this does not include the power to launch a what you might call a discretionary or a non-defensive war. If we're going to go in an all-out war over some economic dispute or political dispute, Congress has a veto over that, and it should have that veto. But the founding fathers were incredibly well-read men. You get the idea these are a bunch of old frontiersmen or something. They frequently would quote the writings of Hugo Grotius, Burlamaqui, Battelle, the great what we call publicists of the Law of Nations, mm-hmm. international law scholars. All of those men, Montesquieu, the great French separation of power scholar who Madison in Federalist, it was 47, said was the oracle who was always consulted on issues of separation of powers. And all of these people argued that the control of foreign affairs was part of the executive power and had to be vested in the executive, the king, the prince, what have you, because of institutional competency. That is to say, success in these areas requires such attributes as unity of plan or unity of design. You can't have 536 secretaries of state deciding how we're going to deal with the world. Speed and dispatch. You cannot wait for months for committee hearings to be held and bills to pass and be reconciled between the two branches. And secrecy was a major issue. Indeed, in Federalist number 64, John Jay, by far our most experienced founding father in the foreign affairs field. He had been the Secretary of Foreign Affairs under the Articles of Confederation for many years, and he explained there would be valuable sources of intelligence, foreigners, who would confide in the secrecy of the president but not in that of the Senate or a more numerous popularly elected House of Representatives. And he explained, therefore, the convention have done well. Interesting phraseology. Convention mm-hmm. have done well in so disposing of the treaty power that informing them the president must act with the advice and consent of the Senate, yet, quote, he will be able to manage the business of intelligence as prudence might suggest, end quote. That is to say, the founding fathers did not believe Congress, should have access to government secrets. Why? Because they couldn't keep secrets and foreign sources.
Not then,
them.
Not now. Well, once again, the tyranny of the clock interrupts us, and it's my sad duty to say that we're near the end of our show. So I'd like to thank Professor Robert Turner of the University of Virginia Law School, and I'd also like to thank John Bellinger, the former legal advisor to the State Department and to the National Security Council, currently with the Washington, D.C. firm of Arnold and Porter. My producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.